Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Last night, now Republican Senator-elect of Massachusetts, Scott Brown, could do no wrong.
This is Ariana. And this is Ayla. And just in case anybody who's watching throughout the country, yes, they're both available. No. Only kidding. Ariana definitely is not available, but Ayla is.
He may be in trouble with his daughters for announcing that they are available on national television last night, but it's clear that the combination of impatience with Obama and the clever use of a campaign truck has warmed the hearts of the GOP.
Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy.
Scott Brown, Daddy to a reborn GOP, with 41 votes in the Senate, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, January 20th. I'm John Hockenberry, and The Takeaway is Brown, as in Scott Brown, the new bleak for the Obama administration. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, John. What can Brown do for the Republicans? Huh?
That's good.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. A powerful aftershock struck Haiti just under 2 hours ago. This one, a 6.1 earthquake, shook buildings and sent survivors of last week's quake pouring out of unstable buildings. Soon after this morning's quake struck, we spoke to Pooja Bhatia, a freelance reporter in Haiti.
I was actually just waking up at the time, but I was woken up not only by, you know, the movement of the earth, but also people, you know, yelling and crying out.
It's not possible to know at this time what additional damage the new quake may have caused.
Although our partners, the BBC, reported to us that some buildings apparently have collapsed. Here at home, the Massachusetts Senate seat, held almost exclusively by a Kennedy for the last 50 years, has fallen into Republican hands. Scott Brown defeated Democrat Martha Coakley in a special election for Ted Kennedy's old Senate seat. It could be a devastating blow to President Obama's domestic agenda.
Tonight, the independent majority has delivered a great victory.
Independent majority, a great victory, and a complete resetting of the deck down here in Washington. Let's explore that with Emily Rooney, host of WGBH's Greater Boston. She joins us from Boston. Holy moly, Emily, what the heck happened in Massachusetts?
That's right, John. Holy moly. And I just think it goes to show you that Massachusetts voters don't like to be told how they're going to vote.
And that was part of the issue. But is there anything about what the Massachusetts voters delivered to Scott Brown that's generalizable nationally to Barack Obama?
You know, I don't think it. I know that's the spin everybody's putting on it, but Massachusetts has voted Republicans in important places many times in the past, and certainly in the governor's office, not in the delegation for many, many years. But I think it was time. I think that it was part of the cycle, and Massachusetts has its own health care plan, and I think a lot of voters looked at it and said, we don't need some expensive national plan. We've got our own. Let the states do what we've done.
Well, the takeaway there from Emily Rooney is the Obama administration, at the very least, then, should have known what was possible. Emily Rooney, stay with us. We're going to talk about this in just a moment. Miles?
Back to Haiti now, where U.S. troops are setting up operations on the lawn of Haiti's wrecked presidential palace. Helicopters are now guarding food and aid distribution sites while U.N. security forces patrol the devastated city of Port-au-Prince, trying to keep order. USAID Chief Raj Shah says more medical help is on the way this morning.
The USS Comfort will arrive. That is a major hospital and medical facility with the capacity to work with 1,000 patients.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he's sending more ships to help with the earthquake recovery. Checking the markets this morning, Asian and European markets are down. Futures down as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,725. S&P 1150. The NASDAQ opens at 2320.
Salt may be under siege here in New York. New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg says salt does absolutely nothing for us, and he wants New Yorkers to eat less of it. Is it really so bad? We're going to talk about that in our food segment. And a year later, everyone's evaluating the president.
We love Obama. He's a great neighbor. You just have to give it some time. Give it some time.
How is the president doing? Are the Democrats losing in Massachusetts? Does it mean they're losing nationally? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry down here in Washington on a very sober one-year anniversary, year to the day of the inauguration of Barack Obama. Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee up there in New York. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, John.
We want to keep people reminded that we have all the details on the latest aftershock in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Actually, the aftershock was centered about 35 miles northwest of Port-au-Prince. It's the latest aftershock in Haiti. The update is on our website, and we expect to get a live voice out of Port-au-Prince sometime during this hour. But let's take a look at the big domestic story this morning. Miles, you referred to it there. The Senate seat held for nearly half a century by Ted Kennedy has been won by Republican candidate Scott Brown.
There's no replacing a man like that, but tonight I honor the memory and I pledge to be the very best and try to be a worthy successor to the late Senator Kennedy.
Yes, you'd have to go back to 1972 to find a time when the Senate seat in Massachusetts was held by a Republican. And really, Scott Brown was able to effectively take advantage of sentiments like these at the polling stations. Here's the voice of one voter collected by Jared Bowen, a producer with our member station and partner WGBH in Boston.
Healthcare, don't like what they're doing at all. I think it's a big sham. She's going to vote for it. He isn't. We'll see what happens.
Well, what did happen was the she in that clip there, Martha Coakley, went down to defeat. Democrat candidate Martha Coakley defeated by Scott Brown. The victory is a major loss for Democrats. And as Eric Euland mentioned at the top of the hour, the reason this is significant for the Barack Obama agenda is that it deprives the Democrats of that 60-vote. 60-vote majority is going to be necessary to pass health care reform. Where does that go now? Well, we want to talk about that with Eric Euland. He worked as a top aide for Senate GOP leadership for 18 years and is currently the vice president of the Duberstein Group, a Washington-based lobbying firm. Eric, you're still with us, right?
Yes, indeed.
And sitting next to me here in Washington, takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, it seems to me just inconceivable that the Obama administration would allow this to happen. I mean, it was their decision to focus on the 60-vote majority on health care. I mean, as Eric says, you need it, but to make it the centerpiece, to actually put it front and center in your legislative agenda, really handed the Republicans an opportunity to snatch this away from them, don't you think?
It seems like the Democrats may have been blinded by their own sunshine. The sun shone so bright when they had a 60-vote majority that they were possibly blinded to the scenario of losing it. So health care is extremely complicated now. They still have opportunities to pass it. The scenario that we've been talking about, John, for about 2 weeks, that they may still try to pass a House-Senate deal in the Senate before Scott Brown can be seated, that was still a possibility last night until about 20 minutes after Martha Coakley conceded. And a Democrat, Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, issued a statement saying, we should take no more votes on health care until Scott Brown is seated. It doesn't uphold the, I'm paraphrasing, it doesn't uphold the integrity of the Senate if we do that. So this is a Democrat and a moderate Democrat from a purple state sending signals to the Democratic leadership. Don't try this strategy of voting again on this high-profile issue before Scott Brown is seated. So now they have to think up something else, sending a Senate bill over to the House. They got to think up a new scenario now. Things are very complicated.
Well, I was over in the West Wing last night, and there were boxes and boxes of food being brought in. It was going to be a late night there. Todd Zwillick suggests it's back to square one for the Democrats on health care. Eric Euland, do you agree with that, and is there even a square one?
Well, that's a good question this morning, whether or not there's a square one. As a fallback to coming up with a deal and then passing it again through the House and the Senate, there's also conversation this morning about possibly the House simply passing the Senate bill, which was adopted in the Senate there Christmas Eve, and then coming back at some point in the not-too-distant future and using a fast-track legislative process in the Congress called reconciliation to make final changes to the legislation which are being negotiated over at the White House. As Todd said, that's incredibly complicated, and given the political rot which is set in around health care, the issue of health care, that's an open question whether or not the Democratic majority would be able to pull that off as well.
Well, it seems to me the electorate in Massachusetts, and if you add the electorate in Virginia, where there was a reversal for the Democrats in November, and also in New Jersey, where there was a reversal for the Democrats in the State House, there's no more patience for procedural shenanigans for Pelosi and Reid on health care. Maybe what's been done here is a momentum play to the Republicans that the GOP can now pick up health care and go, relax, guys, we'll take care of this. Eric Ulan, what's the chance of that?
Well, there's every possibility of that as well. Obviously, Democrats have been talking about this issue for a long time, but still have Republicans. But, John, here's a good point. I mean, if you look at the trend line of what's happened here in the last several election cycles, independents really prove out as a controlling factor. So in 02 and 04, independents stuck with Republicans, led to their majorities. In 06 and 08, helped return Democratic control to the Congress and then elect Barack Obama. But in 09, both those gubernatorial races, and now here the first race of 2010, the independents stuck with the Republicans. So whether it's health care or a variety of other domestic policy initiatives the president has on his plate for 2010, the question really comes to the White House and the Democratic majority. Do we stick with the independents, the people who brought us to town, who have real concerns about overspending and excessive government activity here, or do we continue down the path of attempting to satisfy our base on issues like financial re-regulation, climate change, immigration, and the like?
Well, Eric Ulan, I got to ask you, and very quickly before we go, I mean, do you and Republican leadership smell a 1994 reversal, and is Scott Brown sort of the star leading that charge?
Well, he's definitely the star, but it's too early yet to predict a 1994 reversal. Nevertheless, Republicans are looking at a lot of pickup opportunities, and Democrats are extremely nervous about retaining control of the House this morning.
Said with a smile on his face. I can hear it there. Eric Ulan worked as a top aide for Senate GOP leadership for 18 years. He's vice president of the Duberstein Group, Washington-based lobbying firm. Take us out, Todd, real quick.
Democrats, I would disagree with one thing that Eric said. Not necessarily that Democrats think they have to keep going with their base. A lot of Democrats think Barack Obama has ignored his base on labor, on gay rights. And there are a lot of Democrats who say, go hard to the base. That's how you win. You went milquetoast. That's why you lost.
Well, that was some truck up there in Massachusetts. Jay, take us out with the Grateful Dead, will you?
My name is Scott Brown, and I'm running for the United States Senate. This is my truck.
Pack up that truck and drive it right down the wall.
Driving around in Massachusetts in a truck.
And it all started with me, my truck.
He's driving his truck around the Commonwealth.
Let me tell you, when he started to criticize my truck, that's where I draw the line.
I'm Scott Brown, and I drive a truck.
At 15 minutes after the hour now, let's check in on some headlines we're following. Miles?
Another earthquake struck Haiti this morning, apparently an aftershock. The 6.1 magnitude quake hit just after 6 a.m. Eastern time, about 35 miles northwest of the capital of Port-au-Prince. The quake shook buildings and sent more people into the streets. One of them was American journalist and author Michael Dybert. We spoke to him moments after this morning's quake struck.
Well, I was sitting here working on an article, actually, and the building started to sway back and forth quite violently, and you heard this rumble, so we all ran out into the street, basically.
It's not yet clear what additional damage the new quake has caused. Meanwhile, cash that used to flow from other countries into Haiti has slowed to a trickle as companies struggle to reopen money transfer locations in the devastated capital. $1.9 billion in cash transfers is sent to Haiti each year from the U.S. and elsewhere.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats are trying to put a positive spin on that loss of Ted Kennedy's old Senate seat to a Republican. They say the vote should not be seen as a referendum on health care reform. The outcome of yesterday's Massachusetts special election means Republicans have enough Senate votes to block a health care bill. Here at home, the TV world is waiting to hear about a formal announcement on Conan O'Brien's exit from NBC. Here he is on last night's show.
Hello there, I am Conan O'Brien, and I am just 3 days away from the biggest drinking binge in history.
Proposal being worked out would allow O'Brien to work on a competing network as early as the fall. He would be barred from making NBC the butt of his jokes. How are they going to enforce that? Coming up, we'll look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. What did yesterday's Senate election mean for politics nationally? Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our takeouts this morning are focusing on the one-year anniversary of President Obama's inauguration. For the view outside the Beltway, we're joined by two friends of the takeaway, Susanna Capiluto, the news director at Georgia Public Broadcasting, and Adam Ellington, a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Susanna, good to have you with us. We'll start with you, ladies first. You're in Atlanta, a place I know well, a little pinprick of blue and a sea of red there. What are they thinking of the president these days?
Well, these days, the president is not quite as popular as he used to be in Atlanta. He still, of course, has a strong base here, but outside of Atlanta, it's a different story. And, you know, here people just hope, you know, they have this protective attitude. You know, they say, look, it's only been a year. Give the guy a chance. He inherited a lot of problems. So that's one attitude. On the other hand, we have 10% unemployment. Things are just not turning around as fast. So there is sort of this flickering of dissent.
So what does he have to do? Provide more jobs? Is that what it's all about? How will he curry favor with voters in Atlanta?
Well, with his base in Atlanta, I think what needs to happen is healthcare reform. If that fails, it's going to be devastating. And the other thing is really the economy has to turn around. They have jobs have to come. And things have to turn around, I think, for the president to really, you know, gain some respect again, I guess, from his base here.
All right, Susanna, let's go to Adam Ellington in St. Louis. Adam, Obama lost Missouri by a narrow margin. What if the election were today? What would happen there?
Well, if the election were today, I'm sure he would lose by much more. I think the situation on the ground here in St. Louis is that Obama's base just feels kind of deflated. They were really excited and energized when he took office, and they were hoping for swift and broad change on various fronts, which didn't happen. And now over the summer, state Republicans have sort of really gone to town on the, you know, with the healthcare town halls in Missouri and kept that fervor going and are still hammering away at healthcare opposition in our state.
Yeah, Adam, there's a lot of moving parts to this. There's the whole Tea Party movement. There's the economy.
Right.
There's the healthcare issue. A lot of factors going in there. Try to figure out what the main factor is, if you can.
Oh, it's definitely healthcare, I think, at this point, that's at least driving the opposition to the president's agenda. There are there's a legislative bill in the General Assembly right now that aims to opt Missouri out of mandatory insurance coverage if that is what is passed in Congress. And that bill has gotten a lot of support among state Republicans, and I think they're planning on using it. It's fair to say they're planning on using it as the red meat issue this coming year in our own U.S. Senate election. So it's really become the new guns or the gay marriage issue for state Republicans here.
So this is going to have a big impact on the midterm elections, clearly.
Oh yeah, in Missouri, this is going to be a big thing. We've got a U.S. Senate seat up for grabs, and that's going to be the main issue.
Adam Ellington, reporter for St. Louis Public Radio, Susanna Capiluto with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thank you both.
You know, Miles, it's so interesting. Last night over at the White House, General Wesley Clark was over there, and as the reports out of Massachusetts were coming in, he was wringing his hands like a couple of other Democrats there at this meeting I was at. And they were talking about how healthcare was a giant mistake. It should have been jobs, jobs, jobs. The president has lost his focus on jobs, and that's going to be a huge issue in the 2010 election. So 1 year later, it's so interesting what a difference a year makes here.
Well, as the Clinton campaign famously said, it's the economy, stupid, right?
Right. Well, we decided here in Washington, which really is ground zero of the Barack Obama era, 1 year ago today, the inauguration on the Washington Mall on a chilly morning, huge crowds, high hopes. And we took the pulse of some of the voices on the Mall yesterday. Here's Alem Amara, who's at a carousel along the Mall, remembering what it was like a year ago.
I run this carousel and the popcorn wagon around the Mall. I never seen anything like that in my life. I'm not happy the way it's going on, but still it's too early to tell that I cannot accomplish what he promised.
Breonna Rawlings and Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Yes, I did. I had a lot of expectations for him, especially if he was going to be the first African-American president. He's going to have a lot of expectations from a lot of people.
My name is Nika Rawlings, and I live in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I'm completely confused about the whole uproar over the healthcare situation because, for me, I know people that don't have healthcare, so it seems like to me that for us to try to get something done is absolutely wonderful. So for these people to say this is absolutely ridiculous and the wrong way to go and all that, it's like, well, what about those people who don't have healthcare? I bet you have healthcare.
Well, you can hear the frustration in some of those voices. The people President Obama inspired most last year, you'll recall, were the legions of young Americans, many who couldn't even vote but were inspired to be the foot soldiers of his organization. Todd Zwillick and our producer Jim Colgan were out on the mall yesterday, and here's two George Washington University students.
I was not of voting age when the election came around, but I did actively volunteer to campaign for Obama. I'm definitely pleased with some of the things that have happened in the last year. I can't say that I've been 100% pleased with the way that he addressed healthcare reform and kind of not taking that leadership that he took with the economic stimulus package.
I mainly just had hope in the fact that I felt that he could truly like bring our country together. And I don't think that's really happening right now. I know the healthcare legislature's going, you know, a little slow. But I still have hope in the guy. I would just like to see him kind of bring Congress together. And I mean, I know that's almost impossible to do, but like nothing's getting done.
What's your take on the Obama administration 1 year on? What do you want to see most in the next year? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Coming up in the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti, what is the best way to help the orphans of Haiti, whose number has more than doubled since last week's devastating earthquake, estimated to be a tenth of the population? Their fate. We'll discuss that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Within the last hour, an aftershock, a magnitude 6.0 earthquake, hit Haiti again. One more aftershock in the devastating earthquake aftermath that we've been reporting about for more than a week. The epicenter was about 35 miles northwest from the capital, Port-au-Prince. And on a very, very sketchy Skype connection from Port-au-Prince, joining us now is Pooja Bhatia, a freelance journalist working for the Wall Street Journal in Haiti. Pooja, I'm just going to give you two questions, if you could answer them. But first of all, tell me what it was like when the earthquake hit about an hour or so ago, and how is it complicating relief efforts?
Well, undoubtedly it will complicate relief efforts, although it's too early to assess what damage might have been done. It's reasonable to think that buildings that were already precarious a lot more damage, and some of that damage will, you know, trickle onto the streets and make getting around that much more difficult. The aftershock itself was long. I was actually just waking up at the time, but I was woken up not only by, you know, the movement of the earth, but also people, you know, yelling and crying out.
All right. From Port-au-Prince, Pooja Bhatia, freelance journalist in Haiti. And, you know, before the quake in Haiti, Haiti had almost 400,000 orphans. But some estimates put the population of orphaned and displaced children now, in the wake of the earthquake, at almost a million. And that's one tenth of Haiti's population. Listen. You're hearing the sounds of young children at an orphanage during the massive earthquake that pounded Haiti last week. It's audio courteous of WCPO. And joining us now to talk about this enormous social problem of dealing with all of the children who have been orphaned by the quake and the pre-existing orphan problem in Haiti is Sarah Smith, Director of Children's Programs at the International Rescue Committee. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, the scale of this orphan problem in Haiti, give us a sense of that.
Well, as you said, it was huge to begin with, and now the scale is even more enormous. It is unclear exactly how many orphans there are in Haiti, and we are trying to get better estimates and better information, but there are certainly huge numbers of children who are either orphaned or have been separated from their family members and are trying to find them now.
And U.S. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley says that the U.S. is very much concerned about them and is making a massive effort to try to deal with it.
We are bending over backwards to try to protect and to as many children as possible in Haiti and move those that we can to get medical attention or on to their adoptive parents.
Now, moving Haitian children to so-called adoptive parents on a massive scale, what are your worries in a situation like that, Sarah Smith?
There are quite a few worries. First of all, I think the main concern is that children who are not prepared or in a place or appropriate for adoption would be moved. The process of identifying and registering children determining whether or not they are appropriate for adoption is a long process, and typically in an emergency like this, adoption is not the first measure. The first measure is trying to identify known and safe families for children to stay with in their communities. The ideal situation is to keep kids in a familiar surrounding with family members or with others that they know, and not to remove them from a familiar setting, because this just can increase their distress and make it harder for them to recover ultimately. So the challenge is just going through that process of identifying and registering children and identifying those who are appropriate for adoption.
Isn't there a danger of that, though, with the fragile and non-existent infrastructure inside Haiti of keeping children in a kind of a holding pattern, even if they are close to their sort of emotional connections?
Yes, it certainly isn't easy, and I think the international community and the child protection actors on the ground and working very closely with the Haitian government will put in place a process for doing this. I think the best holding pattern, though, for children is family-based care, and usually in situations like this, there are lots of families who perhaps have lost children of their own and are willing and very able to take care of children safely. There are also alternative care options that can be set up and safe spaces for children to stay. So there are options, and it's much better to keep them in those options than to move them to a place that might be unfamiliar or inappropriate for them.
A U.S. official described the scale of the relief operation as needing to sustain a population of 3 million people on a more or less open-ended basis. If we just take the young people, the kid piece of this, what is the scale of what's going to have to be done in terms of sustaining people in Haiti or moving them to safer locations?
It's massive.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
The scale is huge, and as you said, the numbers are huge. I think estimates said that 40% of the population was under 14 years old. So there are huge numbers of children, and I think the good news is that the scale of the efforts is also huge. Thankfully, people are being incredibly generous, and there's a lot of funding and a lot of resources going into helping people and really serving children in particular.
But it's fair to say that the takeaway here is even though the need is massive and the scale of the relief operation is massive, we shouldn't allow a massive effort to make draconian decisions that may result in things that we're going to regret years later, right?
Yes, that's certainly my take.
All right. Sarah Smith is Director of Children's Programs at the International Rescue Committee, talking about both the scale and the complexity of the orphan problem in Haiti this morning. And now let's take a look at some headlines. Miles?
More on this morning's earthquake in Haiti, John. This one, 6.1 in magnitude, shook buildings and sent survivors of last week's 7.0 quake pouring out of unstable buildings. It's not possible at this time to know what additional damage the new quake may have caused. Also unclear at this time how today's aftershock further hampers recovery efforts. Yesterday, State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley said aid distribution was improving.
The assistance that is getting to the airport is flowing out to the people of Haiti. The challenge is that we are not yet at the level where we can sustain a population of 3 million people.
But Alain Loi, the UN chief of peacekeeping operations, says violence in some places is hampering the delivery of aid.
Of course the violence have increased since the first days. Of course it's still increasing, but it's not widespread. It's still isolated case, violent and terrible cases, but they are not. It's not widespread all over France.
Last week's magnitude 7 quake killed an estimated 200,000 people, injured 250,000, and left 1.5 million homeless.
Many of them children, as we were just discussing. Here in the U.S., Republican Scott Brown pulled off one of the biggest upsets in Massachusetts political history last night, defeating Democrat Martha Coakley to become the state's next U.S. senator, along with becoming the first Republican senator from the state in nearly 30 years. Brown's election potentially derails President Obama's hopes for a health care overhaul. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick said on this program within the hour that the Democrats have few options. Even one of their own said last night they simply have the House passed this existing Senate bill. That's not going to work. Scott Brown credits the independent majority in his state for his win in Massachusetts. Checking the markets very, very quickly. Asian and European markets down. Futures down, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,725. That's what we're watching this morning.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien.
And I'm John Hockenberry. With some voices of America reacting yesterday to what the voters in Massachusetts did, they elected Republican Scott Brown to fill Ted Kennedy's long-held Senate seat. Today we're asking you, what did this election mean to politics nationally? What do you think, Mike, from Rhode Island?
Massachusetts is definitely a referendum against the Obama administration. Obama went to Washington talking the talk of reform, but his walk is basically just cronyism, politicians in Washington, more of the same. Heads up, more to come.
And here's what Devin from New Jersey had to say.
I think Barack Obama is like the new guy on the job. Great work ethic, tell he's trying very hard. Just can be a little bit annoying. Maybe he just needs to find his groove.
And some voters have expressed more overt disappointment in the job the Obama administration has done so far. Here's Ryan. He's a student at George Washington University.
I was hopeful for the new and progressive leadership that he represented for all of us and for a breakthrough in race relations for the United States. Today, I really don't think that he has pushed a very aggressive, progressive agenda. And I don't think that he's really actually given us much of a breakthrough politically because he's using politics as usual.
Voices here in Washington responding to the Obama administration 1 year later. High hopes dashed there. Here's the voice of another student who felt let down by the president's promises for change.
War that, you know, and military action that we're involved in around the world, I think people expected more change. And I think people are a little bit kind of just wind has been taken out of the sail on those issues because he hasn't been forceful enough.
Well, it wasn't all criticism here on the streets of Washington, D.C. Everyone wasn't critical of the president's first year in office. Here's Nika. She was a little more forgiving of the president's achievements in the first year.
You know, I knew that he is a human, that he could not come in and absolutely in one day, 1 year, even 4 years, be able to completely change the way our government works. That's impossible for anybody to do, let alone him. I mean, I think we put way too much expectation on one individual. It can't be done by one person. It has to be a collective.
And the next take came from Lester in Medfield. I don't know where Medfield is, what state it is. Lester says it's less a referendum on the president, but even the party and a plea for more bipartisanship in government coming from him. Maybe Medfield, Mass.
The reason why Scott Brown won was that he and many other people, including myself, don't want a juggernaut in Washington. 60 Democrats can basically take over the Senate and push through virtually any bills they want, and we really think that they need to try to build a coalition of all people, not just Democrats.
And we heard from Mark in New York City.
This single-handedly has resuscitated the moribund Republican Party and gives that party now an opportunity to truly participate as a partner in a bipartisan government. I think the president is going to have to rethink completely all of the strategies, in particular the need for bipartisanship, which has been woefully absent in connection with the health care bill. It's not enough to just be assured of having Democratic votes and pushing through legislation. This legislation is so important, it needs bipartisan support.
Well, but the White House is going to be back to square one on day one of year two. What do you think? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Miles O'Brien in New York City, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation. John Hockenberry in Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning there, Miles.
Coming up, Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the New York Times bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, joins the show to talk about the inspiration behind her newest memoir. Committed is the title, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Right now, here's a check of the leading stories coming at you at 47 minutes after the hour. In Haiti this morning, a 6.1 magnitude aftershock struck near the capital, Port-au-Prince. Just after 6 a.m. Eastern Time, there are reports that buildings were shaking and people began running out into the streets. It's not yet clear what additional damage the new quake has caused.
Joining us from the formidable BBC team that's on the ground in Port-au-Prince covering the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti is Christian Fraser. He's on the line now. Christian, is it possible to tell if this 6.0 aftershock has added to the chaos in some significant, clear way to the devastation that's already there?
Well, I think that's extremely likely, given that a lot of these weakened buildings are in fairly precarious positions. And remember that however slim the hope is that people are still alive, there are people digging in the rubble and people are sleeping in the open near buildings. So you would imagine, we've not had any reports of injuries or deaths yet, but you would imagine that there would be some, given how precarious the situation. This was, as you said, a magnitude of 6 at around 3 minutes past 6 in the morning, so a lot of people would still be sleeping. Localized about 35 miles northwest of Port-au-Prince and a lot deeper than the one last week, about 13.7 miles down. So it was still pretty scary, though, I have to say. And I think the real sad thing is the sort of reaction of the community that is around us. Of course, they're deeply traumatized by what has happened. A lot of them still choosing to sleep out in the open, even given that there are rooms in this building behind me that are still available. They'd rather sleep under the stars. And it wasn't so much the shaking that woke me up. It was the screaming and the sheer sound of terror around us as people ran into the streets.
It must be incredibly demoralizing. I know you're not a geologist, Christian Fraser of the BBC, but the difference between a 7.0 earthquake and a 6.0 earthquake is basically times 10. It's a tenth the size of what happened a week ago.
Yeah, that's what I'm led to believe. And to be honest, as I say, it was pretty scary for me, so I can't imagine what it was like last week. But I think the relief here is that it was a little bit further outside Port-au-Prince. We don't know what damage it's done northwest, but if it had been here in the city again and a little bit shallower than it clearly was, then we could have been talking about a major, major problem. We'll get out today, we'll see what there is. But I know from people who are coming back from the airport that buildings that were standing this morning before the earthquake, they have collapsed. I think we're going to hear reports, through the day of just what went on this morning, and it might not be good.
A shifting landscape in a tragic land, indeed. Thank you, Christian Fraser, BBC correspondent in Haiti, covering the 1.5 million people homeless in Haiti. That's the latest number there. World Food Program has delivered more than 250,000 ready-to-eat food rations, but there's still severe congestion at that airport in Haiti. Here at home, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats trying to put a positive spin on the loss of Ted Kennedy's old seat to a Republican, Scott Brown. Here's what Speaker Pelosi said.
We will have quality, affordable health care for all Americans, and it will be soon.
Trying to sound positive there. Yesterday's special election, though, means Republicans have enough Senate votes to block Obama's health care bill. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Eat, pray, love, and then what? How do you follow up a book that spent 57 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list? That is the enviable dilemma author Elizabeth Gilbert faced as she got back to writing after such a stunning success. Eat, Pray, Love was a memoir that told the story of her emotional and physical journey after a crushing divorce. So why not another memoir, a sequel? This one is about her reluctant entry into the world of matrimony for the second time. The title is Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, very well. You got married to get a green card, essentially. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, at the end of my travels with Eat, Pray, Love, as readers of that book might remember, I fell in love with this lovely Brazilian gentleman, and we commenced to building a life together, and the only problem was that, he wasn't a citizen of the United States, and we wanted to live here. And we were trying to get around that, but we had an unpleasant run-in with the Homeland Security Department at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport who essentially told us that we had no choice other than to get married if he wanted to be here. So it's sort of a shotgun wedding with the INS holding the other end of the shotgun.
Wow.
And the book is about my efforts to find a way to be comfortable with marriage after having been through such a bad divorce.
It's interesting. You were committed to him, but you weren't committed to the institution of marriage. What's the difference?
Right. Well, the difference is one of the things you learn when you go through a divorce is that promise that you make to each other on your wedding day is also extended into a contract that you enter into with the state. And when you try to disband a marriage and you have to wait for a couple of years to get permission from the state to be granted a divorce, you realize just how involved the government has become in your private life. And the fact that we didn't want to have children, and so we didn't feel we needed, you know, that legal sanction of marriage to protect the family, just made us feel like maybe we'd like to leave the government out of it. But unfortunately, you know, you can't have intimacy without privacy, and you can't have privacy without rights, and you can't have rights without some sort of state sanction. So we decided to go for it.
So how did you come to terms with this, you know, lack of privacy or whatever you gave up in order to make it possible for you to come back to the U.S.?
Well, what I did was we spent 10 months out of the country trying to get back in on a fiancé visa, and I used that time to do absolutely nothing but study and contemplate the subject of matrimony and talk to everybody that I met when we were traveling around the world, waiting to get back into the United States, and read every book that I could have my historian sister ship me back from Philadelphia. And for one thing, I got a huge historical perspective on the idea of marriage, and it changed a bit my notion of it, because what I thought of as a very rigid, box-shaped social structure that's been passed down intact for thousands of years is actually, when you look at it closely, this ever-evolving, liquid, long-term social science experiment that has been changing and altering with every generation in order to stay relevant. You know, the obvious example of that being that none of us would accept marriage on its 14th century terms, not even the most conservative commentators in the world, you know. And so marriage changes, and the people who change it are those who are within it. You know, it's almost like we're each given tools as we enter into that couplehood, and we shape it from within. And when I saw it in that perspective, I started to think, okay, I'm part of this long evolving historical process. I'm not being crammed into this narrow, rigid box.
Well, I love your perspective, Elizabeth, and I'm a big fan of your work. And, you know, people shouldn't think that even though you're so brilliant, you're not romantic. You're very, very romantic. But in your perspective here, you have a unique, you can answer this question, probably no one else in the world can. Which is worse, divorce or Homeland Security at Fort Worth Airport?
You know what, after that encounter with the Homeland Security at Fort Worth Airport, I remember right before they handcuffed my sweetheart and took him to jail and then deported him, he grabs me and he said, "I love you so much, I will even marry you." Because that's what it came down to in terms of romance. Like, oh,
boy, that's
I guess
true
we
love.
Have to do this,
yeah.
You know. So I guess the answer is Homeland Security's worse.
What's worse, though, for you as a writer, you wrote a lot of books before your success with Eat, Pray, Love that weren't as widely received, to say the least. You write in your book, interestingly, that when you wrote for a small audience, you said in one critical way, it was comforting. If I humiliated myself too atrociously, at least there wouldn't be many witnesses. And then you go on to say that you wrote this book with 27 women in mind. Was that the key, that you couldn't think about millions of people picking this book up?
Yeah, there is something intimidating about trying to write a book that will satisfy millions of people, especially if the books that you wrote before that were read by dozens and dozens of people. So I had to kind of go back to that smaller scale. So instead of writing committed for the whole world, I chose the 27 women in the world who are most important to me, my family, friends, relatives, and neighbors, who've all been having conversations about intimacy forever, and I wrote the book for them.
Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the New York Times bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, and maybe a new bestseller, Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. Thanks for your time, and good luck with the book.
Well, you know, that handcuff scene needs to be in the movie, I think, at the very least, Miles. So that was great.
Is there a movie deal?
No, maybe she will get one now because of the takeaway.
Yeah.
So yesterday, the voters of Massachusetts elected Republican Scott Brown to fill Ted Kennedy's long-held Senate seat. That's the big domestic story this morning. And we're asking, what do you think? Was this election a referendum of Obama's job in his first year in office?
And I can't help but think that people just need to relax a little bit. He's only been in office for 1 year, and essentially he's trying to take on the world, which needs to be taken on.
And our next caller says, what's the big deal? Since when do we need a filibuster-proof majority to get things done?
You've got to think back to the Bush years. Bush never had a majority and was able to do essentially whatever he wanted. It's just incredibly frustrating, and it really supports the notion that Democrats are kind of useless.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
I'm John Hockenberry. You know how to reach us. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.